everybody. We got a great one today, you know, for a change. Ann Applebaum and Frank Foer join me for our second Year in Review podcast. This time we tackle the world. Ann and Frank were both with me in September. Ann on Ukraine and Frank on his great book, The Last Politician, about Biden's first 2 years in the White House. A lot has happened since I last spoke with them. Of course, October 7th and the war between Israel and Hamas, which, of course, is a good part of our discussion. As I was about to record this monologue, new charges against Hunter Biden were announced for failing to file and pay taxes, tax evasion, and filing false tax returns. Biden has said that he had a period where he was struggling with depression and addicted to drug. You still have to pay your taxes. Now, Biden's lawyer said in a statement that his client had repaid his taxes in full 2 years ago. Now, I obviously don't know what the deal is. James Comer, chairman of the House Oversight Committee, which is investigating Hunter Biden, had recently obtained bank records revealing that Biden's law firm, which had received payments from Chinese state-linked companies and other foreign companies in the past, made direct monthly payments to Joe Biden. Comer claimed the payments, quote, are part of a pattern revealing Joe Biden knew about, participated in, and benefited from his family's influence peddling schemes, unquote. Turns out that these three payments of $1,380 each that occurred in September, October, and November of 2018 were actually for a 2018 Ford Raptor truck that Joe Biden had purchased and that Hunter was using. This was verified by a Washington Post forensic analysis. Now, Comer's committee has subpoenaed Hunter to testify behind closed doors, and Biden says he wants to testify in public before the committee because he and his attorney believe that Comer has reason to distort his testimony, like the chairman distorted the three car payments to his dad. Comer and Jim Jordan, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, said absolutely not. Now, you'll remember that Jim Jordan violated House rules by defying a subpoena to testify before the House January 6th committee. Meanwhile, House Republicans say they're going to do an impeachment inquiry on President Biden. They had hearings on this before, and there was nothing. Their own witnesses, who they had called, said there was nothing there. This is a Republican House that has done nothing. Nothing but take 15 ballots to elect their first speaker, get rid of him, because he used Democrats to pass a CR, a continuing resolution, to keep the government open, and then took 3 weeks to elect a right-wing religious zealot to replace him. Meanwhile, Republicans in the Senate are holding funding for Ukraine and Israel hostage to conservative demands that President Biden substantially choke off the number of migrants admitted to the United States while their asylum claims are considered. So we'll see what happens with that after you give a listen to Ann Applebaum and Frank Foer discuss what happened around the globe in 2023. It's a great one. You know, for a change.
When the news cycle gets busy, it can be tough to keep up with healthy habits. Thrive Market makes it easy to get high-quality groceries delivered right to your door so you can focus on what matters. They carry trusted brands like Rouse and Chomps, and every product is free from over 1,000 sketchy ingredients. With Thrive Market, you can restock your pantry with clean snacks and staples, all without leaving the couch. Go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and get 30% off your first order and a free $60 gift.
I want to get right into this because this is a year in review of the world in geopolitics, and we're going to skip huge subjects like the world overheating. So no COP28, no hottest year on record. So screw our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren if AI doesn't get the great-grandchildren first. My focus will be on Ukraine and Russia, China-U.S. relations with Taiwan and all the other various issues, Israel and Hamas in that region. And if we get to it, is democracy or autocracy winning around the world? I know that's going to be a mixed bag. And we'll talk about Putin and Biden and Trump and Netanyahu and Xi. Let's jump right into Ukraine. There, January 1st, there was the Battle of Bakhmut. And that was in the middle of that battle. And January, I can't remember, that was pretty, the Russians kind of prevailed eventually. Is that right?
The Russians prevailed in Bakhmut, but they did so after losing so many people and taking so much time that it was a kind of Pyrrhic victory. You know, in fact, Bakhmut was symptomatic. Bakhmut was really since the war began, it's the only moment when the Russians have managed to take back any territory.
But at what a cost. And now Prigozhin, Wagner Gruber, was doing that battle. That was their battle,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so that battle was not run by the regular Russian army. It was run by Prigozhin, who leads a mercenary group, or led until his unfortunate plane accident. He led a mercenary group, and most of the people who were doing the fighting there were prisoners.
That's right.
It was an unusual battle in that sense.
And they were just sent in there. These are prisoners, Russian prisoners, who the deal was, what, they get 6 months? If they survived for 6 months, they were freed. Is that correct?
Something like that. I think some of them got cheated and they weren't set free. But they were also used they're literally described as meat assaults. So they were used almost as cannon fodder. I mean, they just threw hundreds of people at the Ukrainians, you know, and as Ukrainians have said to me, you know, it's not a very intelligent way to fight, but we do have to have a bullet to kill every single one of them. And there are a lot of them. And as I said, the casualties were astronomical. And actually, the achievement was pretty narrow.
Yeah. So and what are the death tolls? What are the casualty tolls between Russians and Ukrainians? Now, and I guess include civilians. Do we know, have a rough estimate?
So everybody keeps their casualty numbers secret. The best guess for the Russians is something like 100,000-120,000 dead, and two times that wounded or so otherwise put out of battle. For the Ukrainians, it's thought to be lower. It's, you know, more like 60,000-70,000, but it's, of course, that's still a very high number.
Yeah.
You know, this is a very high casualty war higher than any war the United States has fought in the last several decades, higher than the Soviet war in Afghanistan. And counting civilian casualties is even more difficult because it depends who you count and how you count them. But it's also taken a huge toll on the civilian population and, of course, on the Ukrainian economy. So it continues to wear away at Ukraine in that sense.
Al, can I weigh in with the question, Fran?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Very generous.
Oh, it's a question for Anne.
Not a question. No, why would I ask a question of you?
I don't know. go ahead.
And in war of attrition, you eventually start running up against the hard number of bodies that can be sent into battle. In the relative manpower of Ukraine and Russia, who at this stage do you think is up against that kind of grim upper limit of the bodies that they can throw at battle? At what point does Putin need to risk another call up, another conscription wave? So where are we in just that sheer human?
Yeah. So obviously the Russians have far more people. So if that's what if that's the only thing this war were about, they would win. You know, they do have problems with quality of troops. There's going to be need for further mobilization. There's talk of him postponing it. They're having one of their fake elections in the next few months. And, you know, maybe it will happen after that. But remember that a war of attrition is about other things, too. So it's about, you know, industrial capacity. It's about stamina. It's about politics. It's even about, you know, how effectively can we target the Russian defense industry and make sure that the Russians don't have the ingredients they need to make explosives, which is something that lots of people are working on right now. The goal of the Western powers is actually the same as it's always been, which is to get Russia to leave Ukraine. Many people had hoped over the summer, and this I assume is where your questioning was going to get to sooner or later, many people hoped over the summer that there would be a Ukrainian military victory of some kind that would convince the Russians to go home. And the Ukrainians themselves hoped that. And that did not happen.
Can I ask you on that? Did we kind of blow it a little bit or a lot in terms of not supplying them with the weapons they needed earlier? You know, I know that Biden and others were worried about Putin using, you know, tactical nukes, but did we, were we too slow in giving them what they needed?
I mean, you know, there is no question that we were too slow. I mean, there's a sort of argument about why we were too slow. You know, was it because of we were afraid of escalation? Was it because we couldn't find, you know, our artillery hidden somewhere in Nevada? Was it because it all took a long time? You know, but yes, we were too slow. Ukrainians, you know, did not have what they needed to start, you know, an offensive early enough in the spring. That did give the Russians enough time to build these huge barricades and create these enormous minefields. So yes, we were too slow. And there is a, you know, there are other nuances and there are, people are, have different interpretations of why it went wrong, but the counteroffensive didn't succeed. And so, as I said, now we're looking at what are the other ways to convince Russia to leave.
Did the dam that was blown up, did that have something to do with slowing down the spring or the non-existent spring offensive? It started in June, right?
Yeah, I think it may have been intended to. It may have been just another way of punishing the Ukrainians and, you know, trying to make them suffer so much that they'll stop fighting. That's kind of, that would be really my guess. It seems to have had different, unpredictable effect on the war. I mean, you know, what had been the lake behind the dam is now easier to cross, and maybe that's to the advantage of the Ukrainians. There are arguments either way. I mean, it's not really clear whose military advantage it was, but it was very damaging psychologically and economically. I mean, that was you know, it was thanks to the dam that the irrigation and, systems all over Ukraine. And,
My sense is that we're now at, I mean, this is a stalemate that we're at right now, a kind of a classic stalemate. The one glimmer of hope is that you have these bridgeheads that have been established on the other side of the Dnieper River, but even those seem like they're unlikely to be a sustainable tactical advantage for the Ukrainians. At this point, is there anything that you see plausible that could break the stalemate?
So first of all, stalemate is the problem with the word stalemate is that it implies that nothing is happening, you know, and actually a lot is happening. It's very dynamic. People are fighting all the time. And it could still go either way very fast. So even as we're speaking, I mean, people are shooting each other. So it's not as if they're stuck staring at each other across some trench. I mean, there are things that could happen. I mean, there's...
But just on that point, Anne, doesn't it seem, though, that they're fighting kind of tree line by tree line, that the increments of success at this stage have shifted from where they were maybe months ago, where they were fighting for cities, and now it's really fighting over very small increments?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's fair enough. I'm just saying that it could tip one way or the other. I mean, should, for example, the United States fail to continue aiding Ukraine, and should the Ukrainians run out of ammunition in the next few weeks, then the Russians might make progress fast. That's all
Let's talk about that support for this war in Congress. Where does the speaker stand on it now?
So I spent the last 2 days talking to people about this, and as far as I can tell, the Republicans are willing to pass something, but only in exchange for what the speaker has described as a transformational change in border policy.
Ah.
And so everybody has to guess what that is.
I can guess it's our southern border.
It's our southern border. It's okay. Our southern border.
There we go.
And these are, of course, not related issues. The war in Ukraine is not related to the southern border. But the Republicans have decided to use it as leverage, that, you know, they understand the administration wants this package passed. And what's perplexing to me is that even senators who profess themselves to be very pro-Ukrainian, who understand what's at stake, who understand why a loss would be so disastrous for Europe, but also for us, even they have decided to go along with this weird performative thing that, you know, we need to fix our border and then we can fix Ukraine.
It sounds like today's Republican
Party. It makes me
Party.
Wonder how serious a country we are.
Yeah. No, and it's shocking. It's shocking to see the likes of Susan Collins, who styles herself such a moderate, go along with this type of ploy. And it looks like Lisa Murkowski is plausibly going along with it as well.
What do they want to do to the southern border? Because we could use their things we should be doing with the southern border and our immigration system that really does require a lot of resources. Like, you know, if you come into this country, how long is it before you're adjudicated whether you can, you know, come in?
I mean, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but my sense is that the Biden administration had initially proposed making this type of connection between Ukraine, the border, and Israel. But really, with the border policy, it's not just border policies that are being changed. It's not just a matter of throwing more resources at the border and having more customs and border patrol agents out there. It has to do with changes to the asylum system itself. And
right.
There are centrist changes and changes that the Biden administration and Democrats could broadly accept as it relates to asylum reform. But I think that what the Republicans are proposing,
something different,
in some instances goes too far in erasing parole for certain categories of migrants, more draconian policies than I think the administration probably would like to stomach in the end. But as you're correctly pointing out, it's in the Democrats' interest on some level to have increased funding for the border, because the border is one of their greatest vulnerabilities in the coming election.
Yeah. But the money, it depends where it goes. But just the fact we spent this much more money on the border would be a good talking point, I guess. Just,
and parenthetically, it's kind of crazy. It's also tied up with funding for Israel's war. And Netanyahu keeps talking about how he needs munitions, which the Israelis, much like the Ukrainians, will begin to run low on. Even Israel, which is this history of being this kind of sacrosanct bipartisan point of agreement, isn't enough as an add-on to push through this aid package.
One thing, Anne, that you said that really struck me in the last time we spoke, which is, I don't know, just a couple months ago, which is that Russia is really pursuing a genocide of Ukraine. They see Ukrainians as not legitimately Ukrainians and that they're Russians, and that whenever they come into a town and take it, they kill those who are, or torture and or both those who are Ukrainian, clearly Ukrainian. So it doesn't feel like Ukraine, you were saying, Ukraine will not stop fighting.
The Ukrainians can't stop fighting for exactly the reason you just said. So if they concede territory, what happens to the people on that territory? The mayors and local leaders and teachers and, you know, university professors are all arrested. Concentration camps are created. People are tortured. Children are kidnapped. There are thousands of children have been kidnapped from occupied Ukraine. It's not just about bits of land, you know, or some, you know, empty soil. It's about the people who live there. And so Ukrainians, you know, ceding territory for Ukraine means the loss of people, of their own citizens. So they will fight with sticks and stones if they have to. I mean, I think towards the end. That doesn't mean they wouldn't ever negotiate about anything. I mean, I think there could be, you know, eventually there will be some kind of negotiation. But it's very also important to remember they have to have someone to negotiate with. Right now, the Russians are not ready to negotiate. And on the contrary, the Russians think they're digging down. They're going to stay there. They think the U.S. is weak and divided, which, as we've just heard, you know, maybe it is. And they are going to stay. And so they are not interested in a frozen conflict or whatever, or a ceasefire or a truce. And so the conversation about negotiations is somewhat, it's kind of wishful thinking on the part of people who wish there was a diplomatic solution. But actually, right now, there isn't one.
Let's just, for the sake of a year in review, Prigozhin, of course, who headed the Wagner Group, went to overthrow Vladimir Putin. And that was his goal, right?
Well, no, not clear, actually. I mean, he was kind of protesting the way the war was being fought, and he seems to have expected other people to join him. I think he thought this was going to be a big operation.
Come on, everybody. Something like that.
Something like that. You know, let's go. Let's get. And he was mostly talking about the heads of the army, getting rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they seemed to have not shown up when he called on them. And then Putin made a speech calling him a traitor, which I think seems to have surprised him. And so he made this weird decision to turn back, which was literally the kiss of death. His plane mysteriously crashed a few weeks later.
Yeah. Wow.
And just looking back on that retrospectively, was there any scenario, do you think, in which he could have succeeded if he'd kept on going?
I mean, I don't see how he could have taken Moscow with his 10,000 men. But boy, he could have caused a lot of disruption and chaos. He could have changed the politics of Russia. Yes, I do think so.
So he could have gone out with a bang.
Yes, there could have been a scene, you know, on Red Square, and you know, a coup d'état and historic moment, and you know, there could have been something more elaborate than what happened, which is that they all turned around and went home.
How is Russia doing in terms of economically and getting its weapons, and how has this been affecting them?
It's more stable now than it was before. Sanctions are not harming it as much as they were initially because so many other countries are collaborating and breaking the sanctions, you know, Turkey and China and India and others. I mean, there are weird problems with the economy. You know, there aren't enough young men, for example, to do jobs because so many of them have been mobilized. Quite a lot of the best educated people have left the country. It's a constant sense of instability, but they're getting a lot of weapons from Iran and from North Korea, weapons and ammunition. And so far, that seems to be okay. I mean, as I said, one of the projects now is to make sure that they can't continue to make sophisticated weapons. And we may have some ability to block that. Weirdly, one of the problems with our sanctions has been that there's almost too many of them. And it's very hard to keep track of, you know, second and third level companies that are, you know, you sell something to the Philippines and they sell it to Azerbaijan and then they sell it to the Russia. It's very hard to track that. But we need to be tracking
these are component parts.
We need to be tracking exactly components, the specific things that they need. And I think we're getting a little better at that.
How do the Chinese view, I'm making a segue, view the war in Ukraine? And they don't send Russians weapons, but they do send component parts.
So the Chinese were quite put off by the war. They didn't expect it. They didn't expect something of that scale. And they seem to be of two views. I mean, actually, their sort of political doctrine says countries aren't supposed to invade each other. They have this whole thing about sovereignty. right.
Okay. Is Taiwan a country then?
No.
Yeah, well, that's the joke.
It's not. It's a province, right? You know, and they're very, you know, it's made them very uncomfortable. I mean, she has some personal affinity for Putin. He also increasingly, and maybe this is where you want this conversation to go, and I'm sure Frank has views of this too, you know, he increasingly has a view of the world as there being these links between autocracies that need to defend themselves against liberal ideas and against the liberal world. And he sees Putin as his partner in that project. That's a kind of Chinese, Russian, Belarusian, Venezuelan, Iranian project. They're part of that together.
He's a real dictator, right? I mean, he's like he's a real communist.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure he's a Marxist, but yes, he's a Chinese communist, which is a different thing. Yeah, I mean, he's a dictator. He controls a massive, large country, and he feels an affinity for other people who run similar kinds of political systems. And he would like more people to have that kind of system because then it's better for China. And so the Chinese sell surveillance equipment to other dictatorships, and they share their information systems with other dictatorships. So they see very much themselves as part of this system of not necessarily ideologically compatible dictatorships, but ones that have some interests in common.
Okay, I did bring up Taiwan. What is the status of Taiwan? The United States doesn't call Taiwan a country, right?
Just to step back on the China question a little bit, I mean, I think if you went back maybe to the beginning of the Biden administration, there was within conventional wisdom a sense that China was riding high. And as soon as it got on the other side of its pandemic lockdowns, its economy would revive. And during 2021, you had the Pelosi visit to Taiwan, and then you had all the fallout from that over time, where it seemed like hostilities between the US and China were really ramping up. But kind of at the end of this year, as we look back, it feels like the major storyline as it relates to China is that the economy there did not simply go back to where it was before the lockdown. In fact,
in a big
way, there were considerable problems with the Chinese economy before the lockdown that have now been exacerbated in the form of various bubbles within the Chinese economy. You know, Joe Biden likes to very furiously say he wouldn't want to trade places with Xi because of all the many vulnerabilities that Xi faces as it relates to his economic precariousness. And even though China continues to buzz Taiwan and to do, I think, very aggressive things, it feels a bit like the threat there is maybe a little bit less imminent than it had seemed at the beginning of the year.
The beginning of the year was the balloon, of course.
Yeah. You look at China's role in this latest Mideast crisis, where I think at the beginning of the year, you had China brokering rapprochement between the Saudis and the Iranians. And it looked like they were trying to make a major play for subsuming the historic role that the United States had played in the region. But as it relates to this conflict, I mean, China made noises at the beginning, but they've kind of been nowhere to be seen. It's an interesting data point as it relates to
which conflict China's you're talking about, Israel and Gaza.
Yeah.
They're nowhere to be seen. Now, it wasn't Israel. It wasn't Netanyahu looking at trying to normalize relations with Saudi Arabia before this attack.
Yeah, that's right. And it should be said, Israel is actually a major trading partner with China, which is one of the reasons why China hasn't taken advantage of the conflict in order to beef up its relations with the Arab world.
And what extent does Israel trade with Russia?
It does, but I think that they're pretty profoundly alienated from Russia. I mean, as Anne knows kind of painfully, that it was the Israelis were reluctant to embrace the Ukrainian cause. They have all sorts of oligarchs, both Russian and Ukrainian, who count Tel Aviv as a primary or secondary residence. And Putin and Netanyahu have some sort of affinity for one another. And but I think only now, in the aftermath of this war and Putin's reluctance to condemn Hamas, has that really sunk in Israel that Russia is not their friend.
What are some of the other issues between China? There are military issues, right? And even coordinating or like doing war games or that kind of stuff? Or am I barking up the wrong tree here?
You mean with Russia?
No, with China, with the U.S. Not war games, but informing each other of what they're doing and that kind of thing. I thought there was a period during this year where the Chinese wouldn't even do that.
I mean, one thing that I think has happened is that in the U.S.-China relationship that has been fairly broken is that you have all of these diplomats and officials who normally would be the primary conduits for conducting diplomatic relations with the U.S. or military-to-military relations with the U.S. And because of the political atmosphere back in China, which is so, as you said, communist, and because there's this sense that everybody needs to suck up to Xi, I think for a long time, the U.S. found it very infuriating to have these lower-level conversations with the Chinese because they were just occasions for reciting regime talking points or occasions for trying to embarrass U.S. officials. And that's why the Biden-Xi relationship exists on this separate sorts of planes, in that Biden and Xi have needed to, you know, at these moments where the relationship looks like it's about to go off over the guardrails, they've needed to set up these leader-to-leader conversations where they fall back on this relationship that they've had over the last couple decades in order to have more of not a friendly conversation, but more of a real conversation where they're able to get past some of the posturing.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back with Anne Applebaum and Frank Ford.
When the news cycle gets busy, it can be tough to keep up with healthy habits. Thrive Market makes it easy to get high-quality groceries delivered right to your door so you can focus on what matters. They carry trusted brands like Rouse and Chomps, and every product is free from over 1,000 sketchy ingredients. With Thrive Market, you can restock your pantry with clean snacks and staples, all without leaving the couch. Go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and get 30% off your first order and a free $60 gift.
We're back with Frank Foer and Ann Applebaum. Well, let's go to Israel. Can either start with Netanyahu and his relationship to the Palestinian Authority and Hamas in terms of playing them against each other, or I could go to the judiciary and the Knesset's attempt to overhaul the judicial system.
So that, until October the 7th, that was the story in Israel. I mean, I actually went there last summer to report on it and then wound up using it unexpectedly after October the 7th. But most of what was happening in Israel, you know, for the first 9 months of the year was Netanyahu fighting with a large part of the public and the public organizing these massive weekly demonstrations, you know, in all kinds of creative ways, led by army reservists and the tech industry.
I have an excerpt of something you wrote, which really struck me, and I'll read it here. After the surprise Hamas attack on southern Israel earlier this month, this is you talking or writing, I listened again to tapes of those conversations you had with Israelis during the judicial protests. In almost every one of them, there was a warning note that I didn't pay enough attention to at the time. When I asked people why they had sacrificed their time to join a protest movement, they told me it was because they feared Israel could become not just undemocratic, but unrecognizable, unwelcoming to them and their families. But they also talked about a deeper fear that Israel could cease to exist at all. The deep, angry divide in Israeli politics, divides that are religious and cultural, but that were also deliberately created by Netanyahu and his extremist allies for their political and personal benefit, weren't just a problem for some liberal or secular Israelis. The people I met believed the polarization of Israel was an existential risk for everybody. That really struck me as very profoundly sad. Frank, to what extent has Netanyahu's, the way he has played this for all his years there, in terms of doing everything he can to prevent a two-state solution?
I think even more cynically and even more horrifically, he's consistently sacrificed the national interest in order to preserve and extend his political career.
Which I think he's continuing to do today in how he conducts the war.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's not just the conduct of the war. It has to do with what will follow the war, because Gaza is going to be, in some level, an ungovernable disaster when the war is over. And the question is what happens to that pile of rubble when this is over? Will all of Israel's sacrifices in the course of this war culminate in some sort of better future, and some sort of scenario that would prevent a reprise of October 7th. And I think at the end, that requires Israel to have some sort of plan for, you know, what follows Hamas, if eviction of Hamas is indeed ultimately possible.
And is it possible is another question.
I think it's very difficult to say. I find it hard to get a sense of exactly how well the prosecution of the war is going. According to Israel, they've killed about 5,000 Hamas fighters out of, we think, somewhere between 20 and 30,000 Hamas fighters. In terms of the decimation of Hamas's leadership, we know at the very least that Yahya Sinwar, the political head of Hamas within Gaza, is still there. You don't hear lots of reports of Hamas commanders being taken out.
And by killing so many civilians with the bombing, and these are women and children and men, But I don't know what the totals, real totals are. I think Hamas has about 15 or 16,000, maybe more. Other estimates I've heard are lower, but it's a ghastly bargain to say that's how many civilians we have to kill, innocents we have to kill. I mean, Hamas embeds itself with civilians, and they want as many people killed, I think, as possible to discredit Israel. But it's horrible to watch this.
Without a doubt.
So you're saying after this is over, Netanyahu now is going on trial, right, for a number of his charges.
Right. It's at some point that'll happen. At some point, his political future will be imperiled. I mean, I think that's something that there's very broad agreement on, that on the other side of this war, if not sooner, his political career will come to an end. There's simply too much resentment aimed at him for all the ways in which he left his country vulnerable. I mean, the fact that the New York Times now has this memo that the Israelis prepared that saw the entire attack coming. And it's not necessarily just Netanyahu's fault, or maybe not even Netanyahu's fault in particular, that the military failed to make preparations, but it was clearly symptomatic of a broader breakdown that allowed one of the greatest disasters in Israel's history to have occurred.
Yeah, and as I wrote, you know, many people relate this breakdown to his arrogance, to his attempt to undermine Israel's liberal constitution, to create not exactly a dictatorship, but a sort of a more autocratic Israel, you know, to do deals with extremists who were exacerbating and worsening the relationship with the Palestinians. I mean, all of that was part of the lead up to this war.
And what was the motivation to do that? That's what I want to know. I mean, so he got behind the settlers. Well, good.
I mean, he wanted to he didn't want to go to jail. He wanted to make sure that, you know, the court system was friendly to him. He wanted to keep together his extremist coalition. So the Israeli Supreme Court had in the past, not necessarily very effectively or very well, but they did sometimes interfere with more extreme measures taken in the occupied territories in the West Bank and Gaza. And they wanted a free hand there. They didn't want the courts to prevent them from doing whatever they wanted to do. So there were several different reasons why people wanted the court system constrained. And Netanyahu decided to make that a central piece of his government.
And Al, faced with a choice at the beginning of this war, Netanyahu could have formed a coalition government, which would have required him to ditch the settlers and the religious zealots and made common cause with the center of Israeli politics. And it would have probably been the end of Netanyahu's political career, but it would have been the honorable thing to do, because as this war has gone on, it's been his allies, it has been his coalition partners, who've said some of the more atrocious things about Palestinians and about the war in Gaza that get thrown in Israel's face, and all these accusations about genocide that emerge from the international left. And also, they're just a bunch of incompetence. I mean, his foreign minister, his communications minister, all these people are incapable of engaging in the strategic thinking, in the careful diplomacy that would put Israel in a better position at the other side of this war. And the fact that he's continued to stick with these people, even though he admitted Benny Gantz into a war cabinet, which is not the same thing as a coalition government, that failure is going to be something that his country could pay a deep price for.
One of the things I noticed that in the hostage exchange, that a number of the prisoners that Israel released were women, and even I think some children who had not been charged. Did you notice that?
Yes.
What does that say about Israel? And what does that say about Netanyahu? What does it say about the lurch to the right, which has been going on for years? And is that a population thing? Is it that the very orthodox and right-wing settlers are just have more children? And why is Israel gone this way?
I mean, I think there's a combination of things. One is, yes, the number of ultra-Orthodox is much larger than it was at the time of Israel's founding. And they have a view of the world that's specific to them and which is not shared by the liberal and even the centrist population. You know, most Israelis, when I ask them about this, they cite the turning point was the failure of the Oslo Agreement. You know, there was an attempt to create mm-hmm. peace in the 1990s. There was an attempt to negotiate. And it was the failure of that, the so-called Second Intifada, the fact that it proved impossible to negotiate some kind of solution that led a lot of people to say, right, okay, all those peace ideas, you know, all those two-state solution ideas, none of it worked. It's a failure. And I think a lot of Israelis, even those who aren't ultra-Orthodox or aren't far-right, lost faith in that possibility. That's not the only explanation, but it kind of laid the groundwork for what we've seen in the last decade.
One other explanation is that Israel simply became a prosperous society that felt less pressure to pursue a peace process or to revive a peace process, even after the Second Intifada, even after Ehud Olmert made his extraordinary offer to the Palestinians that was rejected. But I think one of the things that could happen in the aftermath of this war is that as I talk to more centrist Israelis, they have a sense that Netanyahu's settler coalition partners were somehow at least partially responsible for Israel's security vulnerabilities.
And seen as such.
In that in the aftermath of this war, there's going to need to be some sort of
reckoning
with the Palestinian question that Israel has neglected for the last 15 years or so. That's what happened in the aftermath of the 1973 war, which is something that people point to. Israel made peace with its historic adversaries. And that at the end of a conflict like this that takes so much out of a country, takes so much out of its adversaries, you do have renewed possibilities for peace.
I've been, and maybe I don't know exactly what's going on in this regard, but I've been heartened by seeing this thing not spread throughout the region. Is that the case thus far? I mean, has Hezbollah firing missiles and rockets in every once in a while, or has that been somehow successful for a reason I don't understand?
I mean, I think it's successful in part because the Americans communicated pretty clearly to Iran by sending carrier groups into the region. And I think it's also probably just not in Iran's cold interest to have a regional war at this point. I mean, I think that if Hezbollah launched a northern front against Israel, it would provide Netanyahu with the pretext or the opportunity to strike Iran's nuclear facilities, which is something that Iran probably doesn't want to see happen. The Iranian regime has its own vulnerabilities at this point. But I agree with you. It's an accomplishment. It's something that the world can congratulate itself on at the end of this year, that this conflict didn't spiral out of control, which it very well could have.
I am told that Biden administration has also asked the Israelis not, essentially, don't go to war with Hezbollah. They've played a role on both sides, trying to, you know, tamp down the possibility of a spread of the conflict.
So does Biden and Tony Blinken, do they get some credit here?
I mean, I think so. I think that, it's still probably premature to be attributing credit for what happens here, since we don't know. But I think that the way that Biden has managed Netanyahu, the way in which he banked so much emotional and political capital with Netanyahu, which was also a genuine expression of his own Zionism, have allowed him to ultimately manage the conflict at key moments. I think the release of the hostages was a genuine accomplishment. And whatever diplomacy went into preventing the escalation of a regional conflict is indeed a genuine accomplishment.
Let's answer my last question that I wanted to have, which is the world getting more democratic or more autocratic? And you're in Washington, D.C. today, but sometimes when I talk to you, you're in Poland.
Yes.
And Poland had what you'd call a good year.
Yep, Poland had a good year. Poland had an election which, thanks to a huge turnout and lots of young women voting, threw a increasingly autocratic ruling party out of power. As we're speaking, it hasn't quite finished yet. We don't have a new government yet, but it did happen. And so that proves it's possible. But I mean, unfortunately, lots of people have said to me, if it weren't for Poland, there would be no good news. We do live in a world where, as I said before, the autocracies work together in new ways across ideologies and across geographies. There's a, weird links between Putin and Hamas. He invited Hamas to Moscow before October the 7th and also since then. He's clearly tried to take advantage both of the conflict and of the emotions that the conflict has created in Europe and in the U.S. Anything that's bad for the U.S. or is bad for the democratic world, he sees as good for him. And he has allies inside the democratic world who will also, both on the far right and the far left, who will help him create chaos. But it's not just him. He directly supports Venezuela. Venezuela is directly connected to Cuba. Cuba is connected to Nicaragua. These are also, autocracies that work together. There's a similar kind of network in Europe between Russia and Belarus. And this is now how that world operates. They share surveillance technology. They share information technology. The corrupt businesses in one country do deals with the corrupt businesses in another country. It's increasingly a consistent system. And I don't think we've quite figured out how to deal with it, how to think about it and what kind of new diplomacy is necessary.
When Biden came to office, he defined his presidency as being a battle between democracy and autocracy that would occur both domestically and abroad. And just to circle back, it does seem striking how the dysfunction at home really is hurting the ability to fight the war for democracy abroad, and that looking forward to the year 2024 and the ways in which the crisis of American democracy could obviously become much, much worse.
The Atlantic Monthly, your magazine, should write something about that.
We did.
Oh, yeah. No, it would be worthy of a special issue, I think.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Well, that'll be a long time coming. Oh, it's out this week?
It's out this week. 24 essays, including one by me and one by Frank about what will happen if Trump wins.
You want the spoiler alert?
Sure. It's not good.
You may find a way to flourish in autocracy.
Oh.
The rest of us are not likely to.
Sorry. Well, thank you guys. That was a good trip around some of the hot spots of the world, and I couldn't have done it with two better folks. So see you next time, okay?
Until happier times.
Until happier times, yes.
Yes, yes. Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.